Well, if I think we'll just go ahead and start the chat. Tell me why, at this late age, after this long career in broadcast journalism, did you decide now to write this this wonderful text on the history of broadcast journalism?
I've been wondering lately whether I really decide that now or not. It occurred to me that back around 1947, 1948, Bob Trout's wife, Kit Trout, Bob Trout, the great dean, I would say, of radio journalism, started out introducing FDR from the White House back in 1933. His wife, Kit, a lovely woman, came into the old CBS newsroom at 485 Madison, and I was standing by the AP teletype machine. I can see it just as clear as can be. And out of nowhere, she said to me, "Why don't you write the history of all of this?" I don't know why she did that. And I disregarded it, you know. It was planted there back in my mind, and I never really thought much about it. Then around 1961, I was getting restless. Ed Murrow had gone to join not only the Voice of America, of course, but he became director of the United States Information Service. And I proposed to Dick Salant that I write a history of CBS News. And he said, "I think what we're doing today and what we're doing tomorrow is what's important. Let's get on with that." So that was where my ambition to write the history died right there. Then I went to teach at American University and discovered they had no history of broadcast journalism, and I was teaching broadcast journalism. I thought it would be a wonderful thing if there was a story of broadcast journalism that they would have. So when I retired, I undertook to start to write it. Now, that was 13 years ago. It seems a terribly long time. It was a lot of work, but I didn't work on it all that time. I just kept coming back to it. And it's finished. I tried to put a lot of good stories in it so that students would be interested. Columbia University Press saw it and thought this was a story everyone would be interested in because of the interest there is in broadcasting, especially in broadcast news today. And that's how it all came about.
Well, it certainly is a story worth telling, but something would indicate to me that because of the ephemeral nature of radio and television, too, that a lot of the history may well have, maybe that's why there was no previous text of any importance, because so much of it was lost simply because people broadcast, the programs went out on the air, and they just evaporated to be held only in our memory.
That's certainly true. I'm sure that is one reason. I was able, I'm so glad, I could correspond with Bob Trout and John Cameron Swayze and Douglas Edwards, who has died now, a wonderful broadcaster, to get them to tell some of their stories about radio news, especially in the early days, some stories about the coverage of the 1948 conventions, which were the first conventions that were covered by television. I feel very, even Leo Rosenberg, who broadcast the results of the Cox-Harding election in 1920, was still alive when I was researching this, and I have two letters from him that I value very much. He died only recently.
Ed, did you know that John Cameron Swayze's son is working with us here as a per diem anchor person?
I knew that. It's interesting how many children of the broadcasters are following in their father's footsteps. I think of Chris Wallace and others doing the same thing. I think that's great.
Well, let's go back a ways and tell me how you were able to get the information together about the earliest days of radio. Of course, there have been some histories written on that, but tell me your sources and how you researched these very, very early days when radio stations were known by a series of numbers and letters.
Yes, yes. I got most of that early material from the Broadcast Pioneers Library in Washington. I was very fortunate, of course. I lived just across the river in Alexandria, and I could get into Washington very easily. And for the first months, I practically lived in the broadcast Pioneers Library there. Catherine Heintz, the librarian, was very helpful. Some of the pictures that I have in the book came from the Broadcast Pioneers Library. I just devoured that stuff. I read a lot of things I knew I would never use just because they were interesting. There's just so much material there that's good. I really did get most of it from there.
Now, there's been a lot of debate about which was the first commercial radio station to go on the air, and you address this in quite detail in your book. So let me ask you, what was the first radio station?
Well, you said first commercial radio station.
Yes.
Once,
there were some
and then
experimental
you said the first. Yes, the yeah, first right. radio station. These were two different animals. Well, there's a lot of controversy over which was the first. Some of those early stations didn't have call letters. They had a combination of numbers and letters. In 1920, when KDKA broadcast the returns from the Pittsburgh Post and the Harding Cox election, they, in a way, can claim legitimately they were the first because they were the first licensed by the government under the system that exists today. But in Detroit, there was a station, I forget exactly, I think it was 8MK or something like that, which also broadcast those returns. And in fact, 2 years earlier had broadcast the state election returns. It becomes a very hazardous thing to say who was first in any of these areas.
But you conclude on the side of KDKA.
If it was the first licensed station under the present system, yes. But even if you take the Detroit station or the Pittsburgh station, Lee DeForest broadcast presidential election returns in 1916. Now, that's one thing I found in Lee DeForest's autobiography, and that was news to me. He calls his biography Father of Radio. So he wasn't very reticent about claiming his role in the development of radio. He calls himself a father of radio. But he tells about that and how here in New York he had an experimental station up near High Bridge, and he got hold of the returns from the New York Times and broadcast them, and he got the election wrong. He said Charles Evan Hughes had won when he went off the air. And, of course, it was Woodrow Wilson.
Well, Lee DeForest, of course, was the man who patented the vacuum tube.
Yes.
But would he be legitimately called the first first newscaster?
Not really. Not really. I doubt there were more than 200 or 300 people heard that broadcast. And they were all amateurs, of course, or experimenters with radio, or wireless, as they call it then.
Who do you conclude was the first newscaster?
I don't do that. I have a whole section giving the research that people who scholars that just devoted themselves to that, and they don't quite agree. And there's the evidence that they found, and I leave it there.
Radio started out primarily as an entertainment medium, and news was rather secondary, isn't that true?
Yes. Sarnoff, in his famous memorandum, 1915, they call it the Radio Music Box Memorandum. He made that to one of the very early, I don't think it was the DeForest organization, but they did not act on it. 5 years later, Sarnoff did. And Sarnoff pushed it because he was manufacturing radio sets at that time and thought if they went into broadcasting, that would spur the sale of radio sets manufactured by RCA. And the two things reinforced each other. But in that original memorandum, he has a line that it could also besides music could be used for the dissemination of information.
When did it become apparent that radio was a natural to disseminate news?
I think it just became big with World War II, the Munich crisis. People, to use the cliche, were glued to their sets, really, during those 18 days that H.V. Kaltenborn was on the air. Had a couch, a bed, moved in into Studio 9 there at CBS, and just lived there, and meals were brought in, and he was on the air almost continuously during the Munich crisis, those 18 days. I know personally that's when I began really following what radio was doing. Then with World War II, it emerged as a major medium of information. It came of age, I would say, in World War II.
But the newspapers gave the radio a very difficult time, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Refusing to allow them to use the wire services.
Yes, they did. It's interesting, at the very beginning, Lowell Thomas told me once, the news service would call him up and say, "How many times did you use us this week?" And then they would brag about it. Lowell Thomas quoted the United Press 31 times this past week. They felt good about it. Then when advertising began appearing on radio, they saw a threat in that, and then they tried to curb radio and fix it so radio would not be able to carry news. And then emerged what they call the press radio war. And
they almost succeeded, except that CBS formed its own news gathering service, didn't
it? Yes, it did. Paul White organized that, and it was fairly successful. He got a lot of stations across the country to cooperate with it. And it's one of the reasons that the boycott broke down, because CBS established its own. Over at NBC, I've got to add, despite my prejudice for CBS, over at NBC, Abe Schechter, who was the first head of news at NBC, was a sort of a one-man news bureau. Lowell Thomas was on NBC at that time, and of course wanted to get all the news he could get. A lot of it was rewritten from newspapers. But if there was a bank robbery, say, out in Burbank or someplace, or Chicago, Abe Schechter would get on the phone and get a quote from the sheriff or the state police, and then he'd give that to Lowell Thomas, and Lowell Thomas would report that, and it kind of made Lowell Thomas look very good, and Thomas was so famous that anybody Abe Schechter called and said, "I'm calling for Lowell Thomas," he got the information. Lowell Thomas felt very, very proud about that.
That's kind of the way we do it today.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
You can call somebody and say you're calling from CBS, and they almost always return your calls.
Right.
You give a lot of credit to Paul White, don't you, the first news director at CBS?
Yes, I do, and I think rightfully so. I think a lot of credit also should go to Ed Klauber, who came over to CBS. Paley found him at the New York Times, where he was an assistant city editor, and brought him over. And I don't think Klauber gets quite the credit that is due him. He was the one, I think, that convinced Paley, "Let's go the news route." You see, at that time, NBC had the top entertainers and the best entertainment programming. CBS was rather starved for good entertainers at that time. So Klauber and Paley said, "Look, let's make ourselves number one for news. This is an area we can expand upon and outclass NBC." And they really worked at that. So this is where you got your good editors and Elmer Davis and H.V. Kaltenborn, who had broadcast much earlier on WEAF, which of course was the key station in the NBC chain. But Kaltenborn came over to CBS, and Elmer Davis, who was so wonderful, then later Admiral and all the rest, William L. Shirer.
I believe you said a moment ago that broadcast news really came of age during World War II. And Murrow's contribution, of course, is well known, has been written about. You joined CBS in 1941, isn't that true?
No, he joined CBS.
No, you.
Oh, yes, 1943.
1943,
February.
You got there almost at the height of the war.
Yes, it was.
And you worked with Edward R. Murrow.
Yes, but not until quite some time after the war. In 1955, Jesse Zalzmer and Johnny Aaron, who were his writers and producers on his nightly radio program, became full-time co-producers of Person to Person. And Ed asked me to join him, and I took their place, and I worked with him for the next 5 years. It was a great privilege. It was one of the best things that ever happened to me.
Edward R. Murrow was a class act. There's no question about that. What sort of, how was he to get along with?
He was very easy to get along with if you could just forget that he was the number one man in his field. There was always a pressure, you know. You're with number one, and you better be good. And if you give him a script, it better be accurate. And so I had been, when I went there as a writer, I was writing 5 newscasts a day. One of them was a 15-minute newscast. And then I became night editor, and then for a short time day editor, and that's when Murrow asked me to join. And when I joined Murrow, I had to write only about 6 minutes of news a day, and I had all day to concentrate on 6 minutes of news or supervising the editing of the tape, if tape was used on it, and he took care of the last 6 minutes. There were about 12 minutes of news and commentary in the program, and I swear I worked just as hard on that 6 minutes as I did on all of those others put together, because it had to be his style exactly. I would read it to myself. If it didn't sound like Murrow, God knows, of course, my voice was not comparable to his, but I tried to get his sound. Can I hear him saying that? And it was a great challenge. It was interesting. When I went to write edit for Ed, Jesse said to me, he said, "I've got some advice for you." He said, "Always carry a package of Camel cigarettes because Ed may run out, and don't give him any adjectives." And I always did. For 5 years, I had a package of Camel cigarettes and matches in my left coat pocket, and I tried not to give him adjectives. Once in a great while, you know, it just really did call for an adjective, and I put it in, and you know, when I got the script back after he was on the air, there was that damning black mark right through that adjective with his number two pencil. He thought, and he was right, that the strength of a sentence lay in its nouns and its verbs, and if you used the right verb and the right noun, it created pictures that were stronger than you would get by embellishing with adjectives. He used adjectives himself. I think that was a little unfair.
I was going to say, some of his, I've heard some of his wartime broadcasts, and there it is, loaded with adjectives. Oh, it's like poetry.
Well, those were his adjectives. But he really, you know, it's incredible. In 5 years, he advised me on a lead one evening. In 5 years, 5 nights a week, for 5 years, he advised me on a lead only once. And that was the afternoon that Joe McCarthy died. And he said, "Just the facts." He stuck his head in my office, and he said, "Just the facts." I thought I knew then what he meant, and he went to his office. Then I started to write the lead on the death of Joe McCarthy, and I realized, well, there were a lot of facts. It was a fact that Murrow had attacked him. It was a fact that he was what he was. A bad man in our political system. And so I had to get up and go in and say, you know, just exactly what are the facts. And he said, cause of death, age, survivors. And that is the way we led the show that night. And even then he received mail and telephone calls accusing him of dancing on McCarthy's grave. That was the reason he wanted just the facts. He didn't want it to be personal in any way that he and Fred Friendly had attacked McCarthy's methods. He wanted it straight. He wanted it objective. But even then, he was attacked for it.
We look back at these great war correspondents, most of them hired by Edward R. Murrow, people like Winston Burdett and Larry LeSueur and Richard C. Hodlett and William L. Shirer. They're all CBS. What were the other networks doing?
Well,
these names were becoming famous.
They weren't doing as well. But, you know, in researching this, I learned a lot of respect for some of the others, too. There was Fred Bate in London when Murrow went to London in 1937, and he was a good journalist. There was a very interesting man called Max Jordan, and he knew German. He like Kaltenborn, he knew German, and when Hitler spoke, he'd translate for the NBC audience what Hitler was saying, just as Kaltenborn was doing for CBS. Frank Jordan scooped the whole world on the end of World War II. He was in Geneva and had the news that Japan was going to capitulate before anyone else. And he ended up as a Jesuit priest. He entered the priesthood. And I discovered that up in the NBC archives. There was a little card, and on it had Jordan, Max, and then down the bottom, Jesuit. And I asked, what was that? And they said, oh, he became a Jesuit priest. It was interesting. I loved researching that part because I didn't know about it.
It's outrageous when you think that GE, which now owns NBC, sold the NBC radio network.
I know.
And WNBC, which was the old WEAF, gone.
I know it. It's hard to believe. Everything's changing. That's one reason I'm glad I finished the book now, because a whole new chapters with the satellite coverage and the changing of broadcast itself, the emergence of CNN, and everything is changing. Some radio and television stations are supplying news to cables, local cable systems. There's this sort of merging, this melding together of the different media. It's just starting, and somebody else is going to pick it up from there, and they'll have a whole new day.
What about the standards in broadcast journalism? Are they as high today as they were in Murrow's time?
I hate to say it. I don't think they are. And what has happened is that broadcasting has become a profit center. It wasn't a profit center 30, 40 years ago. It was something that a station did because it gave them prestige. It enhanced their image in the community. It led to larger listenership because they gave them the news, they gave them good music, they gave them good talk, and also they would have to get their licenses renewed, and they could point to their accomplishments and get the license. Then it became a money center, and the moment it became a money center, and I'm not pretending to be holier than thou. If I were the manager of a station, I would want it to make money. And I would want it to make money in news. It made, say, X number of dollars last year. I'd like to be able to show the owner of the station that it can make X plus Y money this year. It's inevitable. The Pandora's box was open. I don't see how the lid can be closed. And once you're seeking larger and larger audience, you're going to start more and more giving the audience what the audience wants. Now, that sounds perfectly innocent, and really it is, except you also have to give the audience what it needs, and sometimes it's not very interesting. So what I find is more and more sports, more and more gossipy type items, more and more divorces, more and more murders, and on television, more and more blood. I don't see the editing that I used to see, partly because there is so much live reporting. I just marvel at the reporters, such as those at WCBS have, that can come up from somewhere without a script or anything and be so cogent and so good. I would have to have a script, you know, and they can do it so well without a script. But if you don't have a script, that means you aren't taking, there's more opportunity for mistake. There's no editor that goes over your script ahead of you to say, how do you justify this statement, and so forth. So you're getting more news sooner, and that's good, except in some instances, mistakes are made. I don't think there's quite so much attention paid to editing as there used to be.
Oh, you're absolutely right. The emphasis is on reporting and not on the writing.
And I think that's too bad. I'm not going to point a finger at the anchorman, but recently I heard him say before a commercial that the last American forces had left Iraq. This was 2 days after I'd heard that more and more forces were moving into northwest Iraq because of the Kurds. What he meant was the last American forces had left southeast Iraq. But you see, an editor should have caught that. The writer should have had it right in the first place. Then an editor should have caught it, and then the anchor should have. But perhaps the anchor had his attention diverted somewhere else and read this without the time to examine. I think we need more time to think in broadcasting.
Well, we have an all-news operation here, and editors are not used. That copy is written and goes right into the studio and read. And half the time, the anchors ad-lib around it.
I think that's unfortunate. I used to think back in 43, 44, and 45, when NBC didn't have editors, later they did, that was our secret weapon. It wasn't, of course. We had the best correspondence, as you indicated earlier. But it was one of our secret weapons, that we, every single piece of copy. That's how I got to know Merle. I was night editor, and I had to go back and see that this great man was saying what was sold. And once in a great, great while, I did catch him in something that would have embarrassed him. Not because I was smart, but just because from his point of view, it seemed as though anybody would understand what he was saying. And when that happened, he had this expression, good catch. And he never once argued over the point. Small men sometimes did when I tried to correct their copy. He never argued once. And sometimes I think he was really right, perhaps. But he figured, well, if that dummy can't understand it, I'll make it as clear as possible. Then more and more people out there will understand it. He used me, I'm sure, sometimes as a screening device, as a litmus test of whether this stands up for everyone to understand.
Let me tell you what's really sad, and that's the state of AM radio. Here in New York, for example, outside of WCBS Radio, WINS, and maybe a little bit of WOR, the other radio stations don't really have news departments anymore. They may have somebody ripping and reading a newscast, but they're not covering news the way it used to be.
I think that's a great shame. I heard somebody say the other day they're glad that some stations didn't use rip and read anymore. They give no news anymore, especially some of the rock stations. He said because it's better not to have anything than rip and read. I don't agree. I don't care for rip and read copy. I always made students at American University even write from the A wires of the UPI and AP. But I think for a station to have some news from the Associated Press Broadcast Wire or the United Press International Broadcast Wire on the hour or the half hour, to have some news is better than no news at all, even if it's very brief. I don't like anything that cuts back on the enlightenment of the electorate in this country.
Well, when the war in Iraq broke out, I watched a lot of television and I monitored CNN. I really wanted to be there, and I really wanted to go over there because I saw coverage. It was like watching a motion picture in a way, an unfolding story in a way that I had never seen before, because when there was a Scud attack, you saw the reporter duck, dive, you know. It wasn't going to help him. It wasn't going to save his life if the Scud actually landed. But
yes.
But you actually saw it, and you felt it, and you could see the lights, and the, you could see the missiles going up through the air. It was really incredible. I bet you were also impressed, because this was the first time you saw war live.
Yes, this was live. This was war live, and that had never been done on television before. But in Vietnam, it was film at first that was shipped by air, and then of course by satellite, but not live. This was live war. I think if there had not been quite so much censorship, we would have seen a lot more live war. I think there was too much censorship. I didn't like the idea, for example, that a correspondent couldn't talk to a GI without a second lieutenant or somebody there to listen to what the GI said. I got a little picture of Big Brother there, and I think some of the censorship was too much. At the same time, I've got to admit the military had a problem. There were many correspondents there. They could have been dashing all over the place. There's had to be some kind of regulation of where they would go, all over.
That war also pointed out the difference between CBS and CNN. CBS had what it thought was its secret weapon, paying Connie Chung $1,800,000 a year. CNN spent $50,000 for a set of satellite phones. And we began to speculate. Would CBS have been better if they had a couple of those phones over there, or having Connie Chung?
Well, you know the answer to that is obvious. I think
it's an outrage. Most of us are grunts here at CBS, yeah. and when we see this discrepancy, we saw CNN beat us.
Yes,
and we
yes.
saw the high tags that CBS has paid for this talent, so-called
yes.
talent.
Yes.
And for us who are in the rank and file, I think it's outrageous.
Well, CNN planned this very well. They had to get those phones in there. I heard some pretty good reports out of Baghdad from Betsy Aaron, I remember.
Later.
Yeah, later.
Later they
yes,
got their
yes,
act going.
Yes, yes. The yes, of course, we were whooped.
This technology is so amazing. You can go any place with it. And at the end of the war, by the way, we did have some
yes.
Young reporters that I hadn't heard of. The first one, I can't even remember his name now.
I was trying to think.
I can't think of his name. But
he was CBS, and he got into...
A young Canadian reporter.
Oh.
And he went into Kuwait
yes.
before the military went in. And he had live pictures.
Yes, but there was a CBS guy in there,
I'm
too,
talking right? about the CBS
yes.
guy. And I can't... Yeah. You remember his name, Mary Ellen? He was Bob McEwen.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. That was great. And poor Bob Simon and his crew that tried the same sort of thing and got caught. That must have been a horrendous experience.
Well, Ed Bliss, what do you see as the future for broadcast journalism?
I think the future is going to be different from the present. I think we're going to have more and more live reporting. I think radio and television are becoming more and more omnipresent. We're going to have larger television screens. We're going to have better sound on radio. digital sound, and I hope we're going to have more good reporters.
Well, broadcast reporters are going to be there. That's the way America gets
Absolutely.
Its news.
Absolutely.
Well, Ed Bliss, this is a wonderful and valuable book. I was very pleased to have read it and very pleased to have you here at back at CBS.
Oh, yes, I felt real good coming in here today.
Ed Bliss, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.